Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, and I'm talking to Esther Freud about her novel Hideous Kinky. It is a book, quite a celebratory book, yes. Isn't it? About, you know, as it were, escaping yes. the shackles of your own culture.
But I think that is what it speaks to a lot of people. I mean, you know, it's almost like it divides people, maybe. But some people read it and think, oh, thank God I'm at home and everything is normal. And other people think, oh, this dreary drudgery of a life that continues day in and day out the same. I wish I was brave enough and courageous enough just to take off and have an adventure and be, you know, more unconventional than I am. I mean, I think that is the divide. And so I think people click on this book who want to have an escape and an adventure. Certainly, those are the people, I guess, who respond to me most, because they're the ones who really love the book most.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's sort of, I guess that's partly a product, that divide is partly a product of what I wanted to talk about, ask you about in a minute, the sort of having a narrator, a child narrator. But I just wondered, I mean, thinking before we talk at all about that, the mum. I, you know, having confessed I'm on the censorious side of the fence, probably, and this makes me think of, you know, all the good reasons for staying in Tunbridge Wells. I noticed Tunbridge Wells, in the film they always talk about London, you know, yeah. as if you've given up something quite groovy already to go to Morocco. But, I mean, you must surely have expected, perhaps it's difficult to remember, as it were, your motivations, but looking at the book again, it's impossible not to have a grapple with what one thinks of mum, because she has these, contradictory, you know, she's very resourceful, but you think her resourcefulness seems to depend on hooking herself to the next kind of male partner. You never know, of course, quite what the relationships are. You know very little about that. She's sort of, you know, wonderfully open-minded, but she's also, you know, the very last thing, right at the end of the novel, what's the very last thing the narrator says is that they're on the train back to England. I badly wanted to climb up and join her. That's Bea, the sister in the luggage rack. But I thought it'd be safest to stay on the seat in case Mum changed her mind about going home and decided at the last minute to jump off at one of the stations along the way. And she goes off to see the Sufi wise man, doesn't she? And
but that's all the suspense of the book, because what when I wanted to write and didn't feel I had anything to write about, I had this idea that you needed to have a plot that you know, you knew what it was before you started to write. And then I realised, and I read a book that made me realise this, and it was a book by Jean Rhys called Voyage in the Dark, and the book was, it had an emotional plot. It had a plot made up of suspense, of how she was going to manage her life, how she was going to cope with the people and the way that they responded and reacted to her and her sort of precarious place in the world. And it made me think, oh, actually, I have got stories to tell. I don't have to work out a complicated plot, the kind of thing that I don't even necessarily like reading that much. And it filled my mind with ideas of all the stories that I had in my head that were completely emotionally based in their suspense. I want my readers to really want to keep reading, to turn the pages, to be up late at night, but I don't want to rely on, you know, who did it, who didn't do it, have they stolen the money, whatever. And so what I'm doing with that is the suspense is created by, is this child going to be all right? Is she safe? Does she feel safe? Will she ever get home? And so that's what it's all about. And it doesn't mean it's necessarily absolutely true, but it's true for that child. Mm. So that's where I was. I was always in her mind. I never, I tried not to come out and make judgments. I had a few props. What I felt would have been the most helpful thing was just to go back to Morocco, a place I hadn't been since I was six. But I just didn't dare. I thought, what if the whole illusion that I'd held onto so hard for so many years just falls away and I can't remember anything? Or I think who am I to write about this country? I know nothing. So those were my two fears. But what I did have was I had a photograph of myself, age, in fact, it was, my father then did a sketch from the photograph. So it was, this was sort of really what the photograph looked like, about that size as well. And I just imagined that those were my eyes, about that height, and I was just looking at everything. And I looked at that photograph regularly, and I just, everything I imagined seeing, I just saw sort of from that height. And I knew that I couldn't speak only in the words of a five-year-old because it would be too dull.
Yeah, yeah.
But I decided to try and write in the rhythm of a child, and then I could use any words. I found I could almost use any words as long as the rhythm of it was convincing. And so I read everything out loud to myself, and that's how I went
along. So did you think when you did that, I mean, I'm going to ask you about this. I mean, did you... She's a four, I think, for most of the book, isn't she?
She's four. She has a fifth birthday.
Yeah, she has a fifth birthday. And there are things like she can't read and write, and she believes in Father Christmas. But as you say, you didn't, as it were, try to make it a four-year-old's narrative in terms of the words you chose. I mean, did you think of her as a narrator as being a particular age, or did you not sort of worry about that?
I don't know. I did things that I probably wouldn't do now. I tried to make it truthful. I didn't want to give information that seemed joltingly as if I, the author, was saying, I'm four or I'm five, because I sort of thought a child wouldn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
And now I probably would try and give... I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, you'd write a book differently, you know, a year later or, you know, at another time in your life. But I wanted to... It never naturally came into the story that she's saying how old she is with her thoughts and with everything else going on. But then at some point she remembers, you know, there's some kind of, I think it comes in flashback that she remembers having had her fifth birthday,
going
out in a carriage. And then really, in my mind, is that she's four when they set off and that she has her fifth birthday not so long after. That's probably just because that's what happened to me. So in my mind, I didn't set out to explain too much. And if I did ever say, oh, you know, mum was 25 or so, it just seemed jarring, like I was telling the reader. I tried really hard to keep in the sort of mindset of that child who, you know, all the kinds of things I remembered thinking and feeling, I never really remember having those definite thoughts like how old my mother was or how old I was. I was just living there.
It's a peculiar thing, isn't it? Because I was... When I tried to write about this, I sort of found myself trying to think of child narrators and noticing what other people have said before, which is that actually most child narrators aren't child narrators. They're young teenage narrators. They're 13 or 14 or 15. Those are the favourite ages.
Yeah.
And that's because I think one of the reasons is that novelists think, I want a childish vision of things. I want Huckleberry Finn or whatever it is, but I need an extended vocabulary. I can't go back too far because I would have to purge my language of too much.
I can really sympathise with that too. I never felt I had made an actual choice to do that when I was writing the book, which might sound strange when people. Responded to the book and said, gosh, it's so unusual, and what gave you the idea to write it from the point of view of a five-year-old? I went, I don't know, is there another way? It never occurred to me. I started to write something that had happened to me from my childhood, and rather than writing in reflection or as a memoir, I just wrote as if it was happening, you know, in the present tense, in the first person, as if I was the age it happened. I too couldn't really see... It never occurred to me that there was another way to write that story. And so I was amazed by people's reaction.
People thought it was an audacious
and
fictional...
also that they thought it was difficult, because I thought any other way would have been impossible.
I think it is difficult to do it.
Yeah, without... I think it's because I remembered it so well. I'd been thinking about it. I had almost felt like I could physically feel the sensation of holding on to those memories for 20 years. And I felt that if I didn't hold on to them... they would be completely lost and forgotten. I'd never met anyone else who'd been to Morocco. It's not like now that Morocco is somewhere that people go all the time. There's fashion, open a magazine and there's pictures of it. It's so different in the last sort of 10 or 12 years, the way people respond to Morocco. Then it seemed a really far away place that people didn't go to. And so I had this idea I was holding onto, the sort of memory of it, and that it would be lost. And not that I thought anyone else would care, but I minded. And when I started to write it down, it was this wonderful sense of relief that now I wouldn't have to keep remembering it. And in fact, as soon as I wrote it down, you know, I stopped trying to remember any of the things.
So, I mean, one of the consequences of that is you do get this, one of the things about a child's narrative you get, whether it came naturally or whether you had to contrive it, is she describes lots of things, but often she doesn't explain or notice things. And when you were saying that, talking about a novel not necessarily having to have in a conventional sense of plot, there is a consequence. I mean, certainly for me, I suppose, as a reader, there was a consequence of having that child's narrative, which was that a lot of the time I was prompted to sort of wonder what the plot was. You know, not the things that the child necessarily wonders, because there are things the child doesn't know about, which she wonders about.
Yeah.
Like, you know, is this guy her dad who, you know, what? But there are other things that she doesn't seem to wonder about, that you wonder about a lot, or I wondered about a lot. And there's not necessarily an answer, but, I mean, can I give you an example of one which I thought was a brilliant little episode, which sort of also, I suppose, dramatised those kind of uncertainties for the reader about what kind of judgments to make of the adult characters. It's when Mum and Linda you get this little flash of what might be behind them, you know, back at home.
Yeah.
And they're talking, and Linda is reading a letter from her mother, you know, in which she says, "You've got a child? I don't even know its name." And they're roaring with laughter. And Mum and the narrator's mother says, "Oh, yes, you know, my mother only found out when somebody said she'd seen us in London in the street with me with a pushchair." And they're finding this absolutely hilarious. And the child narrator just reports it. Yeah. And on the one hand, it is quite funny because, of course, the baby's called Mob because his dad's an anarchist. And that, you know, "I don't even know his name. If you did know his name." But on the other hand, you know, you're sort of slightly tempted to feel, God, I mean, are these mothers at home so terrible that they can, you know, that they're kind of laughed at so scornfully?
So, you know, rather than explain where they had come from and what had been going on for these women, I was trying to just show my readers what they felt and how what they were escaping from and how young they were, that they still felt... In running rebellion from their mothers, who were, you know, from hopefully what the reader will get from that tiny episode is that they've coming from very strict conventional families that they wouldn't be able to say. I mean, you know, this book is, you know, set in 1967, and, you know, in my mother's case, in reality, she was actually scared that if her parents knew she had children unmarried, she would have her children taken away and she would be put into a home like the Magdalena sisters. That could have happened to her. So that was the actual terrifying reality that she was dealing with. So as a little child narrator, I want to hint for anyone who might have that idea that could be the idea, but not go heavy on it. So there's lots of things going on for lots of levels of readership.
Yeah.
And actually, I remember so clearly writing that paragraph about why she called Mob, because her father's an anarchist. And I remember that sentence completely from being 5 or 6. And as I wrote it down, maybe this is embarrassing, age 26, I got the joke for the first time. I just suddenly saw how funny it was. And I thought, but why have I remembered it all these years? And you
so
know,
that was something you actually remembered?
Completely.
It's somebody whose baby was called Mob.
Absolutely. Yeah. Who the baby did eventually change her name. but, I have a very, very good memory for whole sort of stretches of dialogue, even from age 4, 5, 6. And I don't remember them now because I don't have to. It's a good thing. But as I was writing it, I quite often just wrote down things that I had heard. And like that example of just like there it was printed out. And then I went, oh, I see. Never got it. And
you know.
But yeah, so that was so, you know, I mean, what you find as a writer, I remember reading this quite recently, actually, someone saying, oh, you know, I'm very good at remembering useless things. But I always used to think, not very good at remembering anything useful, but I could remember all sorts of useless things. Then suddenly they were useful. I could put them in my book. So it's odd. That's like a bit of your brain.
So that thing about, you were saying about, you know, what might happen if you had children out of wedlock. There is a sort of little plot thing, isn't there, with John and Moretta.
Yeah.
You find out halfway, the narrator finds out halfway through the book that they had a daughter.
Yes.
Who's taken into, you know, it's one of those things, what's care?
Mm.
You know, whenever the narrator asks a question like, what's sex, what's care, what's anarchy, Mum always says, you know, you've had enough Fanta, doesn't she? But there is a kind of, that's, I suppose, another example of a plot thing that intrigued me and that seemed designed to intrigue me, that I mentioned earlier, Mum's partners or not partners, that there's this funny woman and a man who says they were married, and then they're there at the beginning, and then they sort of disappear, and then they're having another baby. And
you sound so shocked.
No,
I'm sheltered life.
I have, basically,
it's just, you know, the chaos of life when you're young. I mean, one thing maybe I regret is that I never managed to get into the book, because it didn't seem truthful that my mother's very, very young. So I was 4, she was 24. Age 24, you're beautiful, you're travelling. Life is full of adventure and romance and possibility and chaos. I wanted to give the feeling that they're running, that she's running from chaos and she's also running from disapproval, but not too much. So, you know, those two examples that you've given are just a line here and there that hopefully will give you an idea of why she's there without my 5-year-old narrator in her limited ability to show you. So in a way, it was like trying to write a book through layers and layers of muslin. I remember sort of feeling like, God, there's so much I need to tell, but I've only got my 5-year-old to tell it to you. And in some ways, it really helped me, because I didn't have to be completely accurate. If I didn't know something, oh, my narrator doesn't know it either. Didn't have to do research, you know, just found my way through. But then if I really wanted to say something I did know, then I would have to find a way of doing it so it still felt authentic. I was really, really obsessed with making it believable, the voice, and not being coy, not being too knowing. But at the same time, I was sort of almost more wedded and truthful to that than for the story to be clear to people. And so I think that probably is what comes out, actually.
Yeah, no, I remember there's a little example I was just looking at just now when Auntie Rose, is it Rose?
Yeah.
Yeah, Auntie Rose, this woman they meet on the street who gives them almond biscuits and lemonade. And the narrator says, we went into Auntie Rose's house. It was rather odd because she had furniture and sat on a chair. And that's the first time you sort of find out that actually for the last few months or whatever, they live in this room where everything's on the floor.
Yeah.
And of course, when they make a film, they just show that.
Yeah.
But I thought that was, you know, and I thought, oh yes. So, but that's of course just been taken for granted until the narrator notices that this sort of English woman sort of
is
actually
living in a more conventional way, and then it's true. I mean, a lot of the things in the book, I remember. And therefore, it's this funny thing of writing in part from your own memories and autobiographically, is that you know it all, and therefore you're trying to make it work on the paper, but you're sort of forgetting to make it really clear for your reader. And when I've written absolutely that I don't know, and having to make up everything, then in order to convince yourself of it, you're saying, you know, there was no furniture. They had the mattress on the floor covered in rugs. Blah, 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 because you're telling yourself and learning the story yourself. But when you know it, because you can see it right there, you just say they came in, they sat down. You forget that they don't know. It's a really interesting thing of writing, that the more you know, sometimes the less you bother to tell your reader. I mean, I'm never thinking about my reader. I'm trying to make it work for myself. But then you learn it somewhere else, like with Auntie Rose. Suddenly there you see it's different, because then I remember seeing suddenly someone living in a different way.
Mm. But isn't there also a sort of stripping away because of the childish narration, a stripping away of information that might otherwise been quite natural to give as a instead of putting it in? So, for instance, a really basic example about not knowing people's names, not knowing... I mean, you know, when you... I don't want to refer to the film all the time, but the first thing, almost the first thing you hear in the film adaptation is the mother calling the daughter's name.
Yeah.
Lucy. And I saw the film... Luckily, I saw the film after the book,
right,
which is, I think, always better.
Yeah.
And so it hasn't sort of polluted my reading. But I remember seeing this and thinking... And it was very, very jarring, because that's sort of something you never hear in the book. And I don't know how conscious or not it was, but it seemed, reading it as a sort of, you know, as I'm afraid, a sort of academic critic, that she must have decided very carefully to avoid using the narrator's name. I mean, it's easy to avoid using the mother's name, and she also has a name in the film.
Yes.
But to avoid the narrator's name is quite hard, because...
It was hard. It
got
harder.
Because mothers always, you know, they're always...
Saying your name.
They're always going,
in fact, now I'm a mother, I would have done that differently. I realise, actually, you say your child's name all the time and variations on their name all the time. And I'm not really sure. I think it was because I wanted to get inside my character to such an extent, and it was so difficult in some ways to do it, that I felt if she had a name, I'd be coming outside it. And so, and I didn't make any of these conscious decisions, but I'd written quite a lot when I realised she didn't have a name. And then I just couldn't bear to give her one that wasn't mine, because I just didn't feel I'd be able to do it. And then if I gave her my name, it becomes dishonestly autobiographical, and it wasn't completely. And so I just didn't give her a name, and that became difficult. And in fact, one of the most difficult things about writing the blurb, which I had to do for the hardback, was she has no name.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just couldn't do it. It was just a puzzle, and I had to find some strange way around. But it helped me to get into her head, the idea that she doesn't think of herself as anyone, but she is the world. Like, I'm little children, just they are the centre of everything, and therefore she's not someone else's name.
Yeah. And what about, I mean, what about the for lots of people, my 10-year-old picked up this book when I was first writing about it and said, oh, that book looks really good. And I thought she meant because the cover looks sort of interesting.
Yeah.
And I said, why do you say that? She said, the title.
Nice.
That's really good title. What does it mean? And
good.
Yeah, well, it's a really good title. What does it mean? And we were talking about the title just now with Esther's agent, and apparently the title, you didn't even, that wasn't going to be
title. I never had a title. When you're writing a book, it's so nice to have a title. You sort of feel like you're almost there, even if you haven't begun it. And I never had a title, and I finished the book and I wanted to send it out to agents, and I didn't have a title. And the only title is one point in the book where the two little girls are making brick houses in a kind of builder's yard, and the builders are making these, you know, by hand out of mud and straw and singing and making these bricks, and they start to copy them and they make a little house, and they think it might be this or might be that, and then she thinks, or it could be a home for us. And in a rather sentimental way, as a younger child, you know, sentimental about having a home in all this travelling, I thought, oh, it could be called A Home for Us, and I thought it was nice. But I sent it out to some agents, and it came pretty fast back. And then I gave it to a really good friend of mine, and she said, I think you should call it Hideous Kinky. And I just remember thinking, well, just like your daughter, but what? It doesn't mean anything. I know I've used it in the book as a game, and in fact, it was me and my sister's private joke to each other, and we had still, to the point where the book was published, we still used it often, and anything strange, or it was just, we would say it to each other. And I said, oh, I just can't, people will not know, it won't be worth, it doesn't mean anything. And she said, it's just try it. And then when I said, or maybe it could be called Hideous Kinky, well, my first agent who's here, I said, A Home for Us, or maybe Hideous Kinky, she went, Hideous Kinky, which was just the kind of thing me and my sister Bella used to say to each other. Anything strange, we go, Hideous Kinky. And it just says everything you need to say, as you can hear.
It's also what you were saying about how could you have a title that which prompted people to think, what on earth does it mean? I always sort of think they're sort of puzzle titles. There's certain novels and poems as well, and other kinds of stories, which have titles which say you're only going to find out what this title means if you read this. And, I mean, you've kind of done that again. I mean, even your most recent novel, which I've read, Love Falls.
Yes.
You think, now, when am I going to find out why this is called? And you find out on page 87, you find out why it's called that. Or you get a sort of...
And I put that in because of the title.
Yeah, well...
I couldn't find one.
you think there's got to be... I suppose you think, oh, there's got to be a design. And there's one, you even do one, where you've got to read the book, not only to find out what the title means, but to find how it's pronounced. Isn't that right?
I regret that a little.
Yes?
I think that's pushing things too far.
You think that's too... I thought when I saw it's called Gay Glow.
Yes.
But it's not called...
I think it's not great when you don't know how to pronounce the title. I mean, for me, it stops me wanting to say, have you read this great book? You immediately feel sort of somehow intimidated. So they were just about to reprint, Bloomsbury about to reissue it, and I have suggested they do what the American publishers did and call it Summer at Gaglow. Then at least you can say Summer at before you lose all confidence in your own pronunciation.
Well, do you know that there's that bit in... in Persuasion, where Anne Elliot and Captain Benwick are on the seashore, and he's been reading lots of Byronic poetry because he's depressed because his fiancée died. And it says something like, they discussed what they both thought of Byron's The Giaour and indeed how to pronounce the title.
That's good.
And you have to read that to find out how you pronounce it, because it rhymes with...
Right.
So, you know, yeah. I wouldn't abandon what seems like quite a respectable literary precedent.
I know that after Gaglow, I did really think a little bit about titles and how I used that title because it was the one thing that I didn't know very much about that book, but Gaglow was, in fact, a house that our family had owned. And I wanted to hold on to one thing that was true, to sort of pull me along. And so I was loath to give it up because it was my thread. But then, you know, later, I suppose so many people have said, how do you pronounce it? It's made me go, oh, I don't even really know. I just, you know, it's not so important. But certainly with a later book, The Sea House, I had some strange titles that was going to be called. And then one day a friend of mine said, oh, I've just rented a cottage. Do you know it? The Sea House. And I went, oh, it's so simple. I understand what it means. Wouldn't that be nice just to have a title that... just says, and I really enjoyed that. Although, oddly enough, people are always saying, oh, I've just read The Shell House, The Seashore. So maybe it doesn't.
It is kinky, never has that problem.
No. So who's to know? Who's to know? I was actually really worrying about a title recently, and my father said, don't worry so much. No one really says, oh, that title was so good. They say the book was good. And that's really what's important, isn't it?
Well, maybe...
Although, we were talking about...
I think a lot of publishers would say the title's pretty important, but I don't know. We were talking before about whether Lord of the Flies would have been so immediately successful if it had been called Strangers from Within, as the author wanted. Perhaps it would.
Maybe.
Or The Great Gatsby was supposed to be called Trimalchio on West Egg. Difficult to think it would have been the great American novel as that. I don't know. Even if every sentence was the same.
Yeah. No. Okay. Yeah. I really believe you now.
I just wanted to ask you one more thing before I throw you to your readers, which was what you said about sort of how I suppose it's something about how Hideous Kinky has influenced you. In your later novels, in a way, because you were saying it seemed sort of natural to do this business of narrating as a child, and other novels don't do that exactly. But I think lots of people would say, maybe with the exception of The Sea House, that your novels do tend to see things from the point of view, if not of children, of teenagers, and it is a kind of I don't know, when you talk about going back to your own memories, it seems that most of your novels since Hideous Kinky have done something comparable. I mean, it may not be autobiographical in the case of other ones, but you seem preoccupied with sort of imagining, reimagining what it is, sort of not to understand the world in an adult way. Is that fair or not? Why, and if so, why? I mean, why is that sort of interesting thing to do?
I'm really drawn to people experiencing something for the first time, or something that they haven't really come to grips with, and finding their way through it. And I guess that takes you into quite a young person's experience. I never really think, oh, here I am writing about a child, because to me, a 5-year-old and a 17-year-old, or, you know, within a review, they might say, oh, she's writing about children. I think, no, they're just two people. If someone writes many novels and they all have, you know, men of 40 as their main hero.
There are novelists who do that.
And you know, no one says, oh, here we are, another 40-year-old man.
I think they do. I think they say, oh, goodness, you know, more middle-aged angst. Or, I think they do. And I think they particularly say it about men in their 40s who write novels about men in their 40s.
Okay, well, I'm not necessarily pleased about that. I just think that the idea that they would always be the same is what I don't think is the case. You know, that I suppose you're just drawn to a story. The right age for the person who's telling the story kind of reveals itself to you, usually pretty early on. And I'm then completely caught up in that. Mm. And I'm not thinking that there's anything necessarily similar about their journey, but there's no doubt that I find it, I'm really, really fascinated by it. And I actually definitely find it easier. I have to sort of force myself away from the young person's perspective into an adult perspective. I just like to do it. So in the Sea House, there are no children and talking, and there's two little girls who appear, and suddenly they're sort of woo with the story, off they go, and I thought I had to rein them back and keep them playing and being watched by someone older, and but I had to make a real conscious effort, and I didn't find it as naturally easy.
And they also all sort of have, again, I'm not suggesting that Hideous Kinky is a kind of template, but they also all have something that's very much alive in that first novel, which is what you called earlier unconventional backgrounds. It's not that Tolstoy thing, you know, all novels have to be about unhappy families because happy families are so boring. But actually they all have sort of composite families or incomplete families or bohemian or unconventional. I mean, there's a sort of great bit which seems quite characteristic of one of your novels in Peerless Flats quite early on, when the central character is looking at her brother and thinking, God, it must be so odd for my mother because my 5-year-old brother looks so like his dad. And the whole point of it is that, of course, his dad isn't her dad. I mean, and it would be a meaningless sort of reflection. Yes. And his dad is somebody, you know, that she, in a way, has rather little to do with. And he's off on a yacht with a Danish nursery school teacher. But I mean, apart from the fact that may be simply reflects, you know, reality, social reality, that lots of people don't come from sort of, you know, 1950s style kind of normal families. But apart from that, do you think that kind of narratively that it's sort of makes it, it obviously it's of interest to you in novel writing as well? It's not just, can't just be because, well, that's what happens in the world.
I don't know. I think that, I mean, recently I was at a festival and I was wandering around and I heard this woman in a reading some of her poetry, and she introduced it when she was young, probably early 20s, this girl, and she was introduced it by saying, when I was a kid, I just longed for my mum just to dress normally and to just buy white sliced bread and to get some soup in tins. And I remember thinking that as when I was a child, but not knowing anyone else who had those thoughts or had that experience. And she was saying it And everyone was laughing, like, we know, it was so hard, you know. We were dragged off to Glastonbury as well. And so what I was writing about, you know, like 18, 16 years ago with those books, is that this was my experience and I wanted to reflect it because I hadn't seen it written down anywhere. Now, I probably wouldn't write that because it's been written about since, and lots of people in the intervening years have grown up like that through the 70s. I felt like I was, in a way, as a novelist, extremely lucky to be in that first generation of kids. I mean, when we were like that, we were, you know, when they make films about the six, sort of mid-60s, everyone's kind of in floor-length clothes. It was just us. That's what it felt like. And everyone else is completely in the 50s and looking at us like that. In the 70s, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But by that time, we'd become quite conventional. And in fact, someone visited us that we'd met in Morocco, and she then had two little girls and she was split up from one. We were like, oh, we're quite shocked. Where are they going to stay tonight? You know, we'd completely moved on. And so, you know, I just felt like I had a lot of different... I had lived a lot of different lives, and I wanted to sort of put some of it down. I was probably more than saying, this is a good way to write a novel. I just felt the need to get down what I had experienced.
Well, I must stop and give everybody and anybody else a chance. We have a roving microphone, I'm afraid. So who would like to ask Esther anything? Tell her anything.
A couple of things. Firstly, what was your mother's reaction to the book, and was she sort of much to do with when you were putting it together? And then secondly, as a mother now yourself, and just interesting, like me being a mother and thinking about, you know, my children that age and stuff, does it make you reflect differently on it? Or, you know, a kind of few different things there that just...
My mother, you know, it just can't have been easy for her. It's not what you dream of as your children grow up and then just write everything down and remember everything. It's probably your worst, now I'm my mother, my worst nightmare. I always think they won't remember. But she was actually brilliant about it. She knew, as a someone who always was struggling to be creative, I always was doing something creative, how much it meant to me to do something creative and be successful at it. So she read it as a book. You know, is this book working? Is it good? And she was really supportive and really proud. What she found difficult was when reviews came out saying, you know, this mother was totally, you know, irresponsible, dragging. And she was like, I didn't drag you. You were happy to come. You know, people reacted like that. And she found that very hurtful. And she felt, you know, confronted by that. Because, you know, most of her life she's been a mother. That's, you know, like now... It matters to me so much, you know, of course, to all women who are mothers, what people think of their mothering skills. So that was one thing. But, you know, I was lucky with her in that way that she appreciated what I was trying to do. And the other question I can't remember. Oh, as a mother now. Yeah. Do you know, actually, as a mother, I would write so many things differently. You just have so much more compassion and so much more understanding for what people go through and how they're trying to juggle things. And actually, I quite recently took my three kids to Morocco on a holiday. And, you know, it was a very different experience to my experience as a child. But lots of the things were difficult, just like they would have been. And lots of the things were wonderful, like they would have been. And it kind of made me feel... But it really just gave me a new insight into, you know, the reality and her courage. And also how wonderful it was to be somewhere where children are just so loved. I mean, the Arabic culture, they just embrace children with so much warmth. And, you know, you don't spend your whole evening trying to get your kids to bed. You can go out with them into the square. It's just so lovely. There's all that lovely side. So I sort of really got it as well.
It's funny, you know, we've been doing this book club for sort of 3 years or so. And not every novelist we've talked to here, but you'd be amazed by how many of them have been asked by somebody in the audience, what did your mother think when she read this novel?
I think it's what stops a lot of people writing, actually. Yeah. When I sometimes teach some kind of, you know, creative writing class, people say, I just have so much to say, but I don't want to ruin my mother's life, or, you know. Yeah. And I just say, you know, if you have to do it, just do it. It won't... You'll get through it, you know. That is what stops people writing, is there. I think a real writer is a very ruthless person. And because you just think, oh, I'll change it, or something, later.
Question at the front.
I'd just like to say one thing that wasn't mentioned in all this is the relationship between the sisters. I mean, this book seems to me a hymn to friendship. I think it's the most extraordinary sort of blessed relationship between two small children, and how that's described is truly, truly wonderful, and I'm not sure I've ever read that anywhere else. My question is when you wrote this book, you were actually pretty much a working actress, or had been just before. Do you suppose that this extraordinary ability to be the character who is the narrator was an ability that came out of being people who you had acted? Because it is unusual to be able to be somebody as much as you were a child of a very different age.
I think my acting past probably affected this book more than the subsequent ones. And I think partly it's because I read everything aloud, and that seemed almost like a prerequisite that I should continue being an actress as I was writing. And I thought of all the chapters as scenes, and I kind of visualised it all, and I put myself into it in a way that I don't do now in the same way, and maybe that would be a good thing to do, actually. It's just, I never thought of myself as a writer when I was writing this book, and in a way that was very freeing. And I was still acting and trying to get work and actually writing really as a way of making some structure in my day so that I didn't feel so kind of at a loose end when I wasn't working. And I think it did actually really have a big effect, because I sort of approached it in a way like I would have done my characters, you know, trying to remain truthful, not letting anything else come in that I didn't know, and all the strange ways that I had, you know, been trained as a kind of method actress that I had to know everything about my character. So without thinking about it, it probably did make a difference. So, yeah.
Can I follow on from that with a very obvious question of what do you think of the film? I'm aware that a film and a book are very different things, and the last thing you'd want to do in making a film is just take the novel and somehow just write a very obvious, you know, screenplay from it. And I suspect that some of the best adaptations of novels as films have been those that have stayed very loose to the actual book. But it not only was a wonderful book, it was a remarkable film, I thought, particularly the acting of those two girls who conveyed everything so amazingly. Do you have any reaction to the very obvious question of, you know, what did you make of the adaptation of the book into the film?
I felt really lucky. I felt really well served. The people who were making the film were so sympathetic, and they were so passionate about trying to get the spirit of the story. And the one thing that I wanted was that the mother was young, because that was important to me, and that the little girls were truthful. And I was just so well served by both those facts. And the film is actually really quite different from the book. Mm-hmm. And the man who wrote the screenplay, Billy McKinnon, he didn't just sit in his study and write. He went off to Morocco. He lived there for months. He became friends with all the local characters. He'd started to learn Arabic. He'd started to investigate the story of the sort of male hero in the story, Bilal, and what his life really would have been like. You get much more of that than I ever give in the novel. Certainly the Moroccan men, and in fact, you know, Arab men generally that I've met, they say thank you so much for making that film possible, because it's the only depiction of a good Arab man in cinema. And thank you. And it's just really wonderful to have, you know, had that happen. So,
do you? Sorry to be provoking, but do you think were there things, obviously there are things lost, but were there things that were important to you that you thought were lost in the film, perhaps inevitably?
I think the one thing I miss is my fantasy about the film when the rights were first sold. Would it be a little bit like My Life as a Dog, that, you know, everything would be from the child's point of view and in that slightly mysterious way where we know more, but they couldn't ever raise the money on a six-year-old unknown child star in the same way and give the mother a bit part. So they decided that that wasn't going to work, and that they would give the mother the main part, get a star, and then when Kate Winslet came on board, you know, they got the money, and they probably wouldn't have been able to make it with my original screenplays that I wrote. And I just couldn't move on from my vision of it. So I was really grateful. It was taken out of my hands. Hooray.
Well, thanks very much for coming, but especially Esther will sign any books if you'd like to have your book signed. But before she does that, just to say thanks very much to her for coming and talking. Okay. We've got a little table for you outside.
Okay, lovely.